Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. I am your co-host, Sean T. Collins, the founder of BoiledLeather.com, the A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones blog on Tumblr, where this podcast is hosted. I also cover Game of Thrones and various other television programs for Rolling Stone, and write about television for Wired, and write about music for blah, blah, blah. I write a lot. With me, as always, is my co-host.
Stefan Sasse, I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, where I frequently post essays about A Song of Ice and Fire, and I have my own blog for all things concerning nerd stuff. It's called The Nerdstream Era, and you can find it under thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com.
And today, as you might expect, we are talking about Game of Thrones Season 3, which just concluded a few days ago, and... Oh, there's a lot to talk about. I would say that overall, I found it to be a very strong season, probably the strongest season. I think they have a very confident grasp on what they want to do. They don't always maintain that grasp necessarily, but it's its own beast in a way that I don't think it had been before. And I don't mean that just to say that they're more willing to move away from the books, although that does seem ever truer as the series progresses. I just mean they kind of know their own strengths and play to them, and that's what I'm looking for in a television show, pretty much. I want it to deliver what it is, and so I really enjoyed it. But Stefan, I guess I'll let you... What's your overview?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because I initially planned to start this whole episode by stating that season three was the best season so far, and then I started wondering, what is even a good season of Game of Thrones? What is a good episode of Game of Thrones? Because that was always around, especially in the Tower of the Hand, where you get to rate the individual episodes. And I always wondered, what exactly is good? I always end up rating them very high, because I really don't know what to complain about, really. And so I'd like to talk right in the beginning about what for us is good in the sense of a Game of Thrones episode. You just said that you like how they have a good grasp of their own strengths and of their own weaknesses. And I guess one really obvious strength of the show is to use two characters, put them in a room together, and then let them get witty. That always works.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't matter who talks, and it doesn't matter whether the scene makes a lot of sense. I mean, just let me remind you of the infamous pod sex escapade scene. whether you like it or not, it is a very effective scene.
Yeah.
And you might argue, of course, that one could have used screen time, oh precious screen time, to use a scene from the books, but the scene in and of itself, it works. So that's something they really do very well. There are things that they don't do so very well, and I'm not quite sure what they are. Perhaps you have a better grasp of this. It was more obvious in season two, because there were several real blunders in there, and I haven't found anything like it in season three. And I also liked really much that they managed to get a sense of scope into Dany's storyline, because that has been a big problem back in season one, where you are supposed to have this giant Khalasar, and it is, what, 20 guys on horses?
Yeah.
And they really upped the game for Dany's storyline in season three, and it feels like she has an army behind her, and there are lots and lots and lots of people. So that was better than before.
Yes, absolutely.
So what would you say, what didn't they get?
Well, let me start with what they did do well, and I will get... Well, you know what? I'll start where you say I should start. I'm going to follow orders. I think that mostly they just lose a grip on certain characters from time to time, and because, you know, the more you see that character, the more that stands out. The obvious example, I think, historically, has been Catelyn Stark, who's no longer a going concern, and who ended on her highest note in the whole series, I think. That was incredible. Her performance was amazing, and it worked very, very well. But prior to that, she'd been really pushed to the sidelines this season in what I thought was a fairly unfortunate way, and I say that as not the hugest fan of the show's approach to that character or of Michelle Fairley's performance. I thought that it's weird that you're taking a POV character and having literally dozens of other characters have more lines than she does. You're making her so incidental to Rob's storyline. She's pretty much just there to scold him. And in all fairness, as I've said before, she doesn't really do a whole lot in terms of having sort of active agency in her own life during this period in the books either. I've described it many a time. Basically, Catelyn chapters are she thinks about something for most of the chapter until you get to maybe the second to last page. And then someone rides up, some man, and tells her what's been going on in the world of men while she's been stuck in woman world. And that's a deliberate decision on Martin's part, and it's reflective of Catelyn's status, but it doesn't necessarily make for great television. They could have beefed it up. Instead, they kind of went in the opposite direction and marginalized her even further, which was unfortunate. And so there are things like that that they do that bother me from time to time. I think Stannis Baratheon is a character who benefits from Stephen Delane's performance. He's very gravel. He's got this weird gravelly charisma that is very compelling. I think he's really handsome also. That helps. It's odd to say about Stannis Baratheon, but he's got a great look to him. His demeanor is so different than the other characters that he stands out, even though he has relatively little screen time and relatively little to actually do this season. He's literally just kind of sitting around moping, yet he's still compelling to watch. That said, he's not the Stannis that we know from the books. And I like that Stannis. I like the Stannis who's doing this just because he feels he has to. And yet his determination is no less for that. That's really fascinating to me. This guy doesn't want to be king in the books, but he is king. That's his problem. He believes, correctly, sorta, that he is the king. So he must do this. And that's a really interesting motivation to fight in this war, instead of the petulant, somewhat egotistical Stannis that we get in the show. I miss the book Stannis. And, there are various other characters who work in a similar fashion where I'm not a book purist by any stretch of the imagination. But one reads the books because one enjoys them. And when there are specific things you enjoy about the books, and then you go to an adaptation, and those things aren't in there anymore, and you feel like what you're getting is something you enjoy less than the equivalent in the books, then of course you compare it to the books. You can't not. It's a different thing, I like to think, than just sort of quoting chapter and verse and saying, well, the eyes are the wrong color, and they don't wear those kinds of clothes and stuff like that. That's all world-building detail, and that can be important. Even big plot changes I don't mind as much as when there's something very specific that I thought was cool and that I miss. I mean, the classic example is Renly's peach. You know, and why not have it in? Well, it's not in there, and that's too bad.
No one knows.
Right.
Really,
no one knows. But it doesn't make or break the whole show for me. I think what makes the show for me is two things. One, you already talked about, which is how good they are at putting two people in a room and letting them interact. Two is something that I think I really only articulated in my review of the finale, and maybe not even properly articulated in that. I think I may have only properly articulated it when I tweeted a link to it. But Game of Thrones is really good at taking violent imagery and marrying it to emotional impact. They are very good at that. As good as any show on television right now. Boardwalk Empire had some moments, I think, in the back half of... Towards the end of any given season of Boardwalk Empire, there's usually some horrific act of violence that is just absolutely emotionally gutting. And I cried during the last season finale of Boardwalk Empire over one of those things. But Game of Thrones does it with some regularity, and I think most of the standout moments from this season, whether you're talking about Jaime getting his hand chopped off, Egret shooting Jon, Craster's Keep, Dracarys, the fight between the Hound and Beric Dondarrion, Arya's meltdown on the Frey soldiers that they discover, and then, of course, the Red Wedding. What ties them all together is that they're horrifically violent, but the violence sort of communicates the emotional violence going on in the minds and hearts of the characters. That's something I respond to very strongly, It's something that the show has proven itself very, very good at, and I think ought to insulate it from charges of excess and gratuitous violence. It is excessive, but I think excess... nothing succeeds like excess sometimes. And I like gore, and I like spectacle, because sometimes that's the only thing that can communicate just how intense the emotions are. And the show does that very well.
Yeah, definitely. I remember when I watched The Red Wedding, I mean, the whole episode was really, really strange for me, and I guess for you as well as for every book reader, because we knew what was coming. And there was little to no foreshadowing at all as to maximize the impact for the new viewers.
Yeah.
And knowing just how it would end, and you were totally prepared for what would happen and so totally unprepared for seeing it on screen. I mean, I have read these damn books, what, 10 times already at least?
Right.
So I really know this scene. I know Rob gets shot and Catelyn's throat gets slit and all that stuff, but nothing of it prepares you for really seeing it on screen, staged in the way they did it. So that really speaks to how good they are at this. So definitely you got a real good point here. That's something that they excel at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really like, just to draw the circle here, I don't really like most of the fight scenes we have seen in season 3, but it is a very minor thing, but especially the capture of Yunkai when Grey Worm and Jorah and Daario get all 300 on Yunkai. It really pulled me off the show in a way that nothing, not even the totally bungled John plot in season 2 has ever managed to do. When these three slaughtered his younger soldiers with this bravado and, oh, was that all? Oh no, there comes the next wave. I just expected Gerard Butler to come in charging, this is Yunkai, or something like that. It wouldn't have been out of place in this scene.
No,
and
that's
this
true.
Whole scene, I found it so totally out of place. But okay, let's go back to the important stuff.
Okay.
The other thing you mentioned in detail is, and I guess we should stay with it for a moment, is Stannis Baratheon in the show. Because him and Davos are both so different from the books. They're totally different characters, more so than almost any other character they took into the show. And still, I haven't heard many complaints about them. Most people complain about rather minor changes in comparison to what they did to Stannis and Davos especially, but Stannis as well. And I think why it works is just because, one, the actors are pretty excellent.
Yeah.
They pull off a charisma for such characters that is really something strange, because both characters are more or less unlovable. And you are really invested in what they do and in their fate and stuff. And also, I had at times a feeling that the show Stannis is a more coherent character than book Stannis.
Ooh,
I can't really put a finger on it why, but he feels more like more character-like. Not Davos, of course, because Davos is a point of view character in the books. But Stannis, we get a more intimate look at him. Just like we do for Robb Stark, because every character is radically changed solely by the fact that there is someone acting him or her out. And that interpretation of the actor has to shape your view of them. But I guess Stephen Delane's interpretation of Stannis really is compelling in one way and very different to the books. And he does so much with his whole demeanor, his body language. For example, when Davos comes in, rescued from these fingers in the sea, and he doesn't even stand and just turns glancingly and looks at him for a short moment. Oh, you live. It is such. It works so more strongly than it does in the books in comparison, where Stannis at parts comes off as almost cardboard gruff, you know, and inhospitable and stuff. And in the show, he seems to me more like a real character.
Yeah, there's something great that Stephen Delane does, where he has a tendency to sort of talk past whoever he's talking about. You know, he turns his head and he kind of doesn't look, he just kind of snaps his head up a little bit as he talks and throws the words in the general direction of the person he's addressing. But, yes. You know, that's such an interesting and compelling and weird little choice of body language. And
yeah, and he has also a very strange kind of pronunciation.
Yes.
He has not just an accent. I don't mean the accent. I mean the whole thing. He pronounces things where he makes his emphasis and stuff like that. It is a very unique way of talking. Most of the characters in the Game of Thrones always have this tendency for drama because they have to present themselves as nobles and such. And for example, you see it massively in everything the Lannisters do. Mm-hmm. They always talk like they have an audience before them. And Stannis, he is so different because he almost, without caring, talks about his stuff. If you think of the death sentence to Davos in the season finale, he rattles off his titles because he has to, and blah, 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 blah. I sentence you to die, bam, and he wants to walk away because it's done. And this way of talking, it took a bit getting used to for me back in season 2, but in season 3 I was really invested in it.
Yeah.
So there, a massive change from the books worked really in favor of the material.
Mm-hmm. I think that, I'm surprised to hear you say that Davos is different. To me, what's different? Just his atheism?
No, not the atheism. That's something I wouldn't really have noticed at all if people had not pointed it out, right. I have to admit. I don't know why. I just glanced over it. Now, the moment where I thought this is not the Davos from the books was his "you need me" line from the season finale. I can rally your banner, man, and organize your war effort.
Right.
That's nothing.
That's the opposite of what Davos would do in the books, because he's lowborn, and they're like, who the fuck is this guy?
I mean, I understand why they have to do it, because there is simply no room for Axel Florian or Alistair Florian and all the bunch. So you have to have him do it, but that really changes the character, not for the worse or something.
No.
Because the actor really does it well, Liam Cunningham, I guess.
I find him so much more likable in the show than in the books. I know I think Elio Garcia's favorite character in the books, and I've always found that really baffling. Sorry, Elio. But, you know, because he's just so... You don't really ever, I don't think, get much of a sense that this person was once this daring smuggler. He seems like such a wet blanket and such a, you know, sort of... unipolar good guy in the book and a loyal friend to Stannis no matter what. And I think in the show he just feels a little bit more lived in, a little bit more rough and tumble, a little bit more like the boy from Fleabottom that he was. So I do appreciate that.
In the books, he's a bit like Aerys Oakheart. He is more a function than a real character, you know?
Yeah.
He opens as a window in places we couldn't see otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not really a character I could emotionally invest in.
Right, no, he's just the person that gives you access to Stannis.
Yeah. As Aerys Okot gave us access to Dorne.
Right.
So that's different in the show.
Yeah.
And I think much of it has to do with simply the performance of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me back to it. They really have really, really good actors for nearly every role.
I think that's... I spent a lot of time talking to the cast this season. I did a...
Yeah. I envy you.
That was fun, and it was really revealing in the sense that to a man and woman and child, every single person I talked to was almost bizarrely insightful and intelligent and articulate about the character and about the world and about the material and about their relationship as performers to the source material and this fandom. It was really extraordinary to speak to all of them. I spoke mostly with the younger cast. The oldest person I spoke with was Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who I think is 43. So I think it would be different. You know, people ask me, people talk about, you know, would you interview Charles Dance and something like that? And I was like, yeah, I think Charles Dance doesn't read the books. He's interested in what's on the page of his script, and that's about it. So I think when you get up to the older actors, maybe it's just a job is a job, even if it's a very good job. But I think a lot of the younger performers really have a sense of what makes this material special to so many people. And it's special to them. And they try and do justice to it. I heard that again and again. One of the I spoke with both Nikolai Coster-Waldau and Gwendolyn Christie, which I'm really glad I got to do because I got the Jamie Brienne relationship addressed from both sides. And that to me was one of the undisputed highlights of the season. And yes. It's a case where they made some changes from the books, I suppose, as they always do. But I think they took the potential from the books. You know, that's something when you read them, you're like, man, this would be good on television. And it was. It was great. It made me cry. When she says goodbye, Sir Jamie, I mean, that hit me like a ton of bricks, and I started to cry. And that's down to the writing, and it's down to how it was shot, and it's down to the relationship established by those two actors over the course of their time on screen together. And again, that's a storyline where the show's facility with imagery was used to drive home emotional information beyond what dialogue was capable of doing. I think the bathtub scene was absolutely magnificent. And, yes. You know, they're drawing from Martin's choice to put it in that environment. You know, this man and this woman nude, immersed in water with steam and delirium. And, you know, it's an intense image. And the show did it justice. And I think that's scene is more effective than if they had just been walking down the road saying that stuff. I think that the entire episode after Jamie gets his hand chopped off and he's just riding with that dazed look on his eyes with the hand next to him, those shots and the staging of that half-assed fight scene where he tries to escape and they just make a monkey out of him, you know, that really communicated a great deal wordlessly. The bear scene, you know, I just think time and time again, some of the season's strongest images were deployed in service of a very, very complex and touching relationship between two very damaged people. And that's terrific. That's what I'm looking for in Game of Thrones, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so too. And I would like to talk about when we are in the damaged area. Yeah. I think not in respect to characters, but just to take a quick hop back to season two. I think the thing most people agree on is that the whole Night's Watch and Jon plot in season two was where the show really delved into the bad TV area.
Yes, agreed. Yeah.
And I wanted to know, what did you think of the Jon plot in particular and the Night's Watch plot in general in season three?
I really liked it. I mean, I'll take Jon first, Jon and Ygritte. I thought that was magnificently well done. Really sexy, really romantic, really powerful. I liked the addition of this scene where they get this moment together. It's not just him fleeing and her shooting at him as he runs. She manages to catch up with him, and they actually have an exchange. I thought that was Kit Harington's best moment on the show by about a billion miles.
Oh, yeah.
Just him repeating, "I have to go home." I loved that word choice. The idea that this was some sort of vacation from reality, and now it has to end, and he's sad. But he's also sad that he's away from home, and he needs to get back, and that he considers the Night's Watch home. It was so laden with layers of emotion and insight into this character that you'd never been able to get before when all he was doing was sort of walking around and glowering. And, you know, and then she shoots him. And there's this, there's this image of him riding off on his horse, you know, full of arrows, like, you know, like everyone from Saint Sebastian to Boromir. And, you know, he collapses and his brothers rescue him, and just really sort of mythic filmmaking, and yeah, it worked really well. Yeah, and I mean, the sex scene was awesome in the cave. That was great. She was really sexy. The dialogue was terrific. It was funny. And Jesus Christ, the shot at the top of the wall. I mean, they really went for broke there with that, you know, like that that amazing CGI view. And there's them lying there out of breath together and looking up at the sky and then standing up and the camera. Oh yeah, the camera breaks the 180-degree rule just to show you how intense this is, and flips the side that each of them are on, and so all of a sudden you're in this new world with them. A really, 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 really effective combination of filmmaking technique and emotional content from the story. I really liked it. The Night's Watch, I thought, was also pretty well done. You know, there's a case, I think, where you might see a bit of the book purist in me just being like, where's Cold Hands, and why didn't other people see him kill, you know, the other, and why aren't they called others now? Lost is old. Call them others, goddammit. And, you know, the talking gate, I understand why they can't do a talking gate, but it's still a bummer. But I really liked the Crash Just Keep scene. I thought that was very effective. I like that moment where the dude from The Dark Knight Rises is like, you are a bastard. And everyone's like, oh, shit. You know, that's, as I said in the review, that's the equivalent of the moment from Goodfellas where Billy Batts goes, and go home and get your fucking shine box. And you just, nope, took it too far. And, you know, all the Crasher stuff was good. Sam and Gilly, I think, are fun to watch. I really liked some people told me that new viewers in particular responded very strongly when you know when they're at the little abandoned cabin and the White Walker is about to arrive, and you hit one raven arrives on the tree, people are like, oh, ho hum, a raven. And then when a second raven shows up, someone told me somewhere that, like, new viewers that they watched it with were like, oh shit, because you've never seen that before and you obviously know something major is going to happen. So and, you know, I like seeing Sam and Bran interact in Hodor. So, yeah, I thought that material was much, much better than last season, where I never understood why Corrin Halfhand was changed the way he was. Yeah,
I don't either.
Right. I didn't understand. I suppose it was, well, I do understand it was to give a great more screen time, but I still think that could have been done more effectively than the clunky, now they're chasing, now they're flirting, now they're chasing, now they're flirting back and forth that we had instead with Corrin getting captured. Just the whole thing was very shaky to me. And there was none of that this season, I don't think.
I have to say, I came around about, I guess, every change that they did so far, except for this whole John goes with Corrin on this ranging stuff that they did, because it is just so utterly stupid in season two, and it sets back John's really important character development that they now had to implement really hastily. To get back to the assessment of the Night's Watch in season three, I thought it was more of a mixed bag, because in the first 4 or 5 episodes, I really thought that they didn't improve from season two that much. Hines, I don't know how you pronounce the actor. He is a decent men's raider, but it never clicked with me. And the whole stuff where they are north of the wall, it simply doesn't really work the way it seems to be supposed to work. I mean, the giant was great, of course.
Yeah.
But then they go into this tent, and you have Aurel, who simply snarls at Jon the whole time. He only starts to develop as a character once they climb the wall. And then you have Tormund Giantsbane, which was very nicely done. And then you have Mance Rayder. I like you, boy, but I will kill you if you do something stupid. And later you have Tormund repeating the same thing, basically. And all the time, I asked myself, why the hell do they like John? He didn't even say anything that was something like clever. And the whole plot line about John and the Night's Watch starts improving the closer they come to the wall. And once they are over the wall again, it soon becomes so much better for John and Ygritte. The point where they climb the wall is really great. And once they're up it, it is really very good television. It is great emotional moments. The sex scene, as you said, it was also very good. And all of that. But the really meaty stuff that makes me invest in John as a character again, and makes me believe in a casting choice of Kit Harington, was only when they were south of the wall, when you had these scenes at Queen's Crown, and then, of course, later, I have to go home now. That really was a very emotional moment. I wouldn't have expected it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't like it in the beginning, but it really improved. And this leads me instantly to the one thing that's struck me from the very beginning of season three, and that is another thing that they really do very, very well, which is consequence. I mentioned this in my first reviews, and I've seen it arise in nearly every episode of season three, that they are so good at not dropping the balls. They simply know what plot threads they began in season one and season two, what the changes that they made will mean in the future. None of the changes that they made in season one or season two simply leads to the status quo from the books. So they are not just taking a detour or something, but they create a whole new story. Only in details, mostly, but they have an attention to these details that really strikes me. My first example where I really noticed it for the first time was when John was asked by Mance Rayder, why do you want to defect? And I really expected now that he starts this whole story with the code and the Winterfell and stuff, until it occurred to me, of course, it would eat up much too much screen time. And when John then said, it is about Crestor sacrificing to the White Walker, it instantly hit me just how brilliant this was. Because in season two, everybody thought, what a stupid scene, you know? In the books, John had never witnessed Crestor really, no one had witnessed Crestor offering to the White Walkers. And why the hell does everyone know that the White Walkers are around? In the books, it is a major surprise, blah, blah, blah. And in the show, now that they used it for this purpose, it immediately made sense and it fell all together and it created a new continuity. And they did this several times over the whole season where they put up these small changes that were made and used them to very great effect simply because they hadn't forgotten that these changes were made. And that is something very impressive. And I really liked it about the season.
See, I have a problem with that particular storyline because I guess I don't remember from the books exactly how it worked, but I'm reasonably sure that while Lord Commander Mormont was aware of Craster's, I mean, you can't not be aware of Craster's crimes of, you know, raping his daughters and killing his male children, I find it a little tough to believe that Lord Commander Mormont was aware that he was sacrificing them to the White Walkers who were out there roaming around. Like, if he knew that, we would have been out there to see what was going on a long time ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just, so that always kind of bothered me that, because then seriously, John's right. Like, what the fuck are you doing this for? If you know that the White Walkers are out there, you know that this person is sacrificing children to him, and you're like, oh, well, we have bigger fish to fry. It's like, nope, that's the biggest fish, you know? I just don't see Lord Commander Mormont losing sight of who the real enemy is, even if there are people who know that it's, or even if there are people in the Night's Watch who believe that it's the wildlings who are their real problem and not the White Walkers, because they don't believe the White Walkers exist or whatever. If Lord Commander knew, he ought to have done something, and it bugs me that he didn't. But in general, I suppose you're right, and that a lot of the inventions for the season, I think, worked fairly effectively. I mean, you want to talk about Gendry, speaking of inventions for this season?
Yeah, of course, just it will work in their advantage when we get to John being Lord Commander and having to bring all the people around for the White Walkers, because his motivation will be stronger because of this choice, this whole we have to fight against White Walkers, can't you see this? It will have now more ground than it had in the books, so I guess it will help them further down the road. But to Gendry, what do you think of him?
It's a case where they feel that they have a performer and a performance that people are interested in seeing more of, so they're keeping him around and keeping him prominent and consolidating characters so you don't have to meet another bastard and have that whole issue of confusion, and I definitely support that decision. I'm a little skeeved out by the Brotherhood Without Banners giving this kid up to, you know, some lord someplace, effectively. That seems really against their modus operandi and kind of irritating to me. But you know, I think that stuff was fun in general. And his material with Arya was excellent. And, you know, I dug the leech sex thing. I mean, I think that was crazy and fun. So,
yep.
I don't get complaining about it. I mean, I get complaining about it, but I don't know. It was weird. And I like weird. It was very weird, and I like very weird. So, that was appealing to me. And now, who knows what he does? I mean, everyone kind of, I think, is assuming, judging from that my asks, that he will meet up with Brienne and go on the hunt for Sansa with her.
Which would make sense.
Yeah, it would make some sense. But who knows? I guess I'm kind of done guessing about stuff like that. But there you have it.
Yeah, I pretty much liked what they did with him because it gave us one character that is invested in the Brotherhood and then gets disappointed by them, then teleports to Dragonstone together with Melisandre. And from the moment that Melisandre left Dragonstone, I had this hunch that they would swap him with Edric Storm, mm-hmm. because it just makes sense, you know. It saves British screen time. It is terribly unlogical, because for Melisandre to do this trip like she does, but the show has never bothered with that stuff, so let's overlook it. And Joe Dempsey really is a good actor, and he has good stuff to work with. They really write Gendry in a very interesting way compared to the books, where he's just a muscular, sullen boy that doesn't do much else besides.
Right.
And so I'm looking forward to seeing him again, and I think we will see him again. They are not like to throw an asset like that in the wind.
No, yeah, I would agree with you. I think that's also true of Rickon and Osha. I know people are thinking, well, that's the end of them. I don't think that's true at all. They've invented a storyline for them. They're already telling you they're going to the Last Hearth to visit with the Umbers. Maybe we've got the Greyjohn back. Maybe the Greyjohn went home to man the fort. I have no idea. But
yeah, I don't know. It is also possible, because I think you speculated about that Ramsay would go on a hunt. He could run into Rickon and give this whole thing a much more serious angle, you know?
Yeah, well, they need to give Ramsay and Roos and Theon something to do now, and that's something to do, although I guess they'll also be battling Yasha or Ara, whatever the hell, Yara Greyjoy's Ironborn, which I'm a little bit less certain of the wisdom of. But yeah, you know, my point with Rickon and Osha is that they're obviously so crazy about Natalia Tena's performance as Osha. You know, transform the character. It's the character Martin cites all the time as the one that has most affected how he's going to approach writing her in the books. So they're not going to then be like, oh, that's the end of them. You'll see them in season 6 when Davos arrives at Skagos or whatever. Like, that's not, you know, they'll be around. And so they're keeping Gendry around, just like they kept Theon around, and I think that's I don't really question that at all. I think that's something that they'll have to keep doing, eventually at the expense of other characters and storylines, I would imagine. And I think you're really going to start seeing that next season, which is why on Twitter I was like, book purists, you know, God love you, but just stop watching if you hate it that much, because it's only going to get more severe from here. And
absolutely,
you know, I mean, the Gendry storyline, whatever that's going to be, the Yara storyline, the Rickon storyline, and Jaime and Brienne and Qyburn in King's Landing prior to the Purple Wedding, that's all brand new. And you're also probably going to have to come up with something for Stannis to do. He's not just going to sit out 8 episodes and then show up at the end of episode 9 to rescue the Night's Watch at the end of that battle, which is going to be episode 9. So, you're going to be looking at, I'm guessing, possibly a quarter of the storylines will be brand new. So, you either got to, if you can't take the heat, get out the kitchen.
Yeah, perhaps they will try to merge it a little bit with the Feast End storylines, because you are not as committed to the chronology of it all as it might seem in the beginning. I mean, there is nothing hindering Stannis for battling Ramsay before he goes to the wall or something, especially if he captures Yara on the way. I mean, she could teleport into the Narrow Sea. It's not unheard
of.
And so there's a lot of stuff to do that keeps close with the books, but not exactly in the spirit of them. And here, I think we are touching a topic that has become, in these last 2, 3, 4 weeks, a very important one to me, one that really bugs me, and one that brought me in the front lines against a part of the community, because I simply can't stand this nitpicking anymore about really minor details and this really unwillingness to accept and to understand that a TV show is something different than a book. I can't hear this argument anymore about, oh my God, here are 2 minutes of these people talking about Podrick's sex life. We could have used it to see the Blackfish take a poo as he did in the books. And this is just so a non-argument because the show has so different needs and issues that it needs to address compared to the books, where you have so many pages. It's actually a point that you made, I think, that because they have so few screen time in the show, it is only 10 hours after all, and so every minute of it counts, and they have to do something with it in the context of the TV show and not just into trying to get as much stuff from the books on the screen as possible. That has never been the objective. They want to make compelling TV. That's the only thing how this series will ever reach season 7. So they have to make the viewer emotionally invest in stuff. So when people now complain about the Red Wedding being all shock and awe, so yes, that's the whole point of it. And it, of course, when you read the books for the fourth or fifth time, it is not a shock anymore that the Red Wedding happens. But seriously, guys, you need to stop looking at every scene with the knowledge of hindsight from all the books. This seems something that many critics do. They know how a particular storyline will play out later, and with this knowledge, they judge what is done in the specific storyline, and then it is like stuff, oh, Jon's storyline is boring. But if we are honest, Jon's storyline in A Clash of Kings is fucking boring. There is not that much happening. It only starts becoming compelling at the end of A Storm of Swords, and especially in A Dance with Dragons. And it is, of course, if I see it as a whole, because I know the books by heart, it is not anymore like Jon's storyline is boring or Brienne's storyline is boring. When I read The Feast for Crows for the first time, I was bored to death by Brienne's storyline. It was only on a reread that I could accept what it was. And the show doesn't have that luxury. They have to make it count on the very first run, so to speak. And so they have to go for this emotional impact. We can only invest in Podrick as a character that travels around with Brienne if he has been introduced as something more than the guy that trails Tyrion. And they have done that very effectively.
Yeah, I agree with you. People, I brought this up in the bloggingheads.tv video podcast that I did with Alyssa Rosenberg, who's been a guest on this podcast and is one of my favorite Game of Thrones critics, how on a television show, because it's much more finite than a book that's thousands of pages among a series that's further thousands and thousands of pages, things take on weight that they don't necessarily have in a book, because you just have a much more limited canvas. So anything you put on the canvas will stand out and demand attention and eat up emotional and intellectual bandwidth. So you really kind of do have to watch your step. And I guess I understand the idea that, well, I don't want the pod... Then fine, then the Podrick sex thing took up too much room. But you also kind of have to be like a cook and think about the different ingredients that you're having in. And if you're taking all your spare time that's not devoted to moving along the main storylines, just if you're devoting it all to backstory and telling the audience why character X is important, instead of doing something funny or doing something creepy, or doing something gross, or doing something sexy or doing something exciting, thrilling, you're going to lose the audience. And so I don't blame them for a lot of those changes. I'm trying to think. There was something I wanted to say here. I think the thing that bothers me the most about book purism is when it becomes an issue of reading Benioff and Weiss's mind and heart and telling you what they really think of this character or this setting, or I don't know. I find that very, very troubling. As a person who is a critic who also makes art of his own, I really have a hard time with the mind reading. And I'm not necessarily immune to it myself. You know, I've cited the example in the past of how I just assume they're not really interested in prophecy. That's not what they come to the show for. And then later on, I think Brian Cogman explained that they feel they need to be very careful how they use that, because once you introduce it, there's a huge segment of the audience that won't care about anything else. You know, Lost is a great example of how that works. And so I tried very carefully when I discussed, I want to tackle two big topics here. I'll do my best. I tried to approach this very carefully when I tackled the racial imagery, or what I thought of it, in the finale. Those three paragraphs, I wrote sort of one against the final Daenerys scene, one sort of justifying how that was approached, and then a third one on Ramsay beating Theon into accepting his new name of Reek, which I, you know, and all, basically the complaint about the first, about Dany's scene, was that it's this weird white savior vibe, given how not white all of the slaves were, whereas in the books it was very ethnically and skin tonally heterogeneous group. And my complaint about the Theon and Ramsay scene was that it just felt to me like a note-for-note lift from Roots and the My Name is Toby scene, where LeVar Burton's character, Kunta Kinte, is whipped until he accepts his slave name. And a lot of people commented and were like, oh my god, I thought the same thing. Thank you for pointing that out on both counts. I've gotten more people saying, like, Sean, you are just simply smoking crack about this, about the My Name is Toby thing, than literally anything I've ever written. So I tried, and I probably didn't succeed, to not say anything about Benioff and Weiss as people, not say anything about what they think about people who aren't white, people who are white. I think the main mistake I made was more or less insisting that it had to be an homage to Roots, that one scene, when I suppose it really could have been a coincidence. Enough people have said that to me that I suppose it's true. It was just all I thought about when I saw that. And that's maybe my limitation as a critic, that I couldn't see past my own window of perception there.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, so this is my example of it. And I think book purists do it about stuff that I just don't, like, they don't hate the Hound. They don't. Like, you know, you may not be crazy about how he was cast or how the performance is going or how he's written. But, I mean, I think that was the thing I read. Like, you know, they think they like the Hound, but they actually hate him. I'll never forget that. And it's like, how do you know? You don't know about what's in their heart. And just as a very young critic, it was drilled out of me to not read the minds of the people you're writing about. Just, what is the work? What does the work tell you? What does the work say? How does the work work? And beyond that, you know, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must remain silent. So, I don't know. Sorry, that's my little rant.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, I read it too. It is something that occurred to me too when I wrote the reviews for season 3, because I haven't written any reviews for season 1 and 2. And in the beginning, when I noticed this thing about consequences, it just occurred to me that I was perhaps a bit rash in my judgment, or even unfair, because I assumed I presumed, to judge things without knowing what the intent was and where it was heading. Mm-hmm. And so when you read my reviews, you will find that I very often write, I don't really understand why they did it, but I have faith and trust that it will turn out something great. Because, yeah. because in many cases, we simply don't know in which direction they were heading. And it was a particular hurrah moment for me when, in the aftermath of the Red Wedding episode, many people complained about how Arya's whole storyline was destroyed because the Tickler is already dead and she will never have this emotionally so important scene where she stabs him to death like in the books. And I said, hey, people, wait. She will stab someone to death. They will find someone she has good reason to stab to death. Just wait and see. And one episode later, right. we get this crazy soldier who brags about having soon a wolf's head to Rob's body. And I have to say, yes, she got a valid reason. She stabbed him to death. And we have the same, basically the same emotional development that we already that we had in the books too. And so just sit down a bit and relax and perhaps wait for it. Which is also the essence of our last podcast when we talked about feast ends, because in so many things we don't even know how it will end. We simply can't see where the journey is heading, and so it is really hard to judge that stuff. And that is also true for the TV show, even more so than for the books, because we are not as fluent in the TV show as we are in the books.
Yeah.
And this makes it really hard to judge this appropriately before it's all over. And at some points, I'm asking myself, how Brian Cogman and Benioff and Weiss, how are they standing all this? Are they avoiding all the criticism in the internet? Or have they simply developed such a thick hide that they don't care about it anymore? Because I could imagine it is really hard at times.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know Brian keeps abreast of things. So, you know, I'm not sure about Benioff and Weiss. I'd imagine they might be a little further removed, because I think you maybe need to be as a showrunner. You just almost have to insulate yourself. And I think Brian has been sort of the go-between with the fandom and the show. I'm really interested in Vanessa Taylor's approach and perspective, because I think she is, of the writing staff, it's only four people, five if you count Martin, the one that we've heard the least from. And I'd be really curious to know where her position is in all this. But I think, yeah, I mean, I would say two additional things. The first is that, with regard to the race stuff that I brought up in the my review of the finale, I really want to make clear that, you know, because people accused me of accusing them of being racist. And I never said that, because I don't think that. I would have no basis to think that. It's really just, again, an issue of looking at what's on the screen and how it comes across. And, you know, it shouldn't be about, like, picking sides and deciding who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. And either you agree with me and therefore Benioff and Weiss are bad guys, which I don't think, or you disagree with me and therefore I'm a bad guy for ruining your recap, which I also don't think is fair. You know, it's just something I wanted to address. And as I said at the very end of the review, I would love for there to be additional episodes so we could see a sort of complete context for what's up with this and where it's going and what it means and their approach to these issues in general. Because obviously it becomes very important with Dany's storyline, her alien status in this culture, and how, you know, despite her best intentions, she ends up causing a lot of problems for a lot of people. The second thing I would say is, I'm glad you brought up the Red Wedding and people's reaction, book purists' reaction to that. Because I think it's really cockamamie to look around at the reaction that night and the subsequent days, when it essentially lit pop culture on fire. Like, I don't know the last time I saw a television episode do that, of anything. It was an instant, overnight, cultural touchstone that will never go away.
Yes.
You know? It's in the language now. And so to say, oh, well, you know, there was no sense of dread. It's like, talk to a normal human being and see if they had a sense of dread, or see if they, yes. or see, and if they didn't, see if they cared. See if it, like, oh, that was shocking. All right. But I wish I had had more foreboding. Like, I just don't think you do come across the occasional civilian, like Alan Sepinwall, a critic who has, sort of been battling with book readers who want to spoil it for him, that he kind of saw it coming, and since it's characters he didn't really care about, it didn't. It just felt like shock to him. He wasn't that crazy about it. And there are certainly examples like that. But, I mean, people lost their fucking shit over that episode. And so who cares? Ultimately, who cares that you didn't see Grey Wind, like, whining and growling and not wanting to go in? Who cares that they didn't make a huger deal out of Bread and Salt? Who cares that there wasn't all the buildup about Guest Right and... You know, I mean, and you didn't get these glimpses of, like, Catelyn's, like, flashes of, you know, I have a bad feeling about this. Like, who cares? It was great television, you know? It is one of the most iconic episodes of television in the history of television. It really is, you know? I don't think it's too soon to say that. So, you know, I love the way it was handled in the book. Believe me, I've never been more emotionally affected by a work of art than I was by that chapter. I lost sleep over it, literally. I reread the chapter because I was, again, literally convinced I had read it wrong, that this could not have possibly been what I just read. I've never experienced anything like that before or since, so you'd be hard-pressed to find a bigger fan of that segment of the books than me. But, and, you know, because, you know, you can't photocopy those pages from the book and just hold them in front of the camera. And what they did worked very, very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you are touching this whole and cornerstone for nerddom, so to speak, because it has become such a huge thing for everyone. So many people now know what a red wedding is. And it was often quoted these days that Benioff and Weiss, they had their ultimate intention was to make this scene. They are reported to have said that they don't care what happens to Game of Thrones as long as they can do this scene.
Right.
And right in the beginning, before season one aired, I thought that the death of Ned Stark would have an impact like it did in the books, because I always have the feeling that in the books, the death of Ned Stark really sets the tone for the whole series, has become such an important thing to kill off the main character.
Yeah.
And the Red Wedding is also a very, very huge shock. But for me, personally, Ned Stark's death was the more impactful thing. And so I expected somehow that Ned Stark's death in season one would be a similar thing. And now that I have seen The Red Wedding, I know why Benioff and Weiss have said that they want to make this a scene so bad. And they also prove a real grasp on television and on imagery and stuff, because obviously they knew what the impact of it would be, just how it would come across for viewers, especially in regard to Ned's death, which is the only thing you can compare it to. That really shows a foresight that is remarkable, because they have been working on this show since what, 2006?
Yes.
2007?
Yeah.
And to work for 5 or 6 years or even 7 years for this one scene, knowing that all you do in this show really works towards this point where you really make history in some way, that must have been a tremendous feeling and a tremendous responsibility at the same time.
Yeah, and one thing I didn't talk about in my review of the finale that I kind of wish that I had was that I think you're always going to feel a little bit of a sense of anticlimax if they continue this pattern of these big, you know, episode nines. The episode 10 is always going to feel like a bit of a letdown.
Of course.
You know, and there's not really much you can do about that, I don't think. Especially after that particular episode 9, which is the highlight of the entire series from, I'd say, almost most of the readers, you know.
But I don't think it does matter anymore, because in 2 or 3 months, you won't remember that episode 10 was a bit of a letdown. Right. And when you build up anticipation for the next season, you will remember the Red Wedding and stuff happened and I was shocked and I want to be shocked again. Please hit me, Game of Thrones. And you won't really remember that episode 10 was a bit of a letdown. So I guess that particular gamble isn't really one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think in the end, and I've seen this in other critics saying, like, you know, Game of Thrones... Well, in storytelling terms, Game of Thrones is a bit like The Wire, only even grander. The Wire was really best viewed in units of one season rather than one episode.
Absolutely,
I know it had this novelistic structure, which essentially is a soap opera structure. Soap operas don't get any credit for it, but you know, this idea that any given episode doesn't necessarily have a theme, it doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. You're just following different plot lines until you eat up an hour. And by the end of the season, it all makes sense. With Game of Thrones, it's basically like by the end of the series, it'll all make sense. So, but even in the meantime, it makes more sense to look at the show. It doesn't make a whole lot of... I'm trying to think. With the exception of like really stunning episodes that have an obvious through line or climax.
Yeah, Blackwater.
Yeah, Blackwater is the case in point. The episodes matter less than the sort of... gestalt of everything. And so when you look back at Game of Thrones season 3, you're right. Season 10, episode 10 being a bit of a step down from episode 9, it's really not going to matter all that much. Yeah.
And you know, it's serious when you start using German words, right? Gestalt.
I'm glad I could help.
yeah, there's far too few German on the show, so I have to put it up a bit. So I had a point that I wanted to say. Yes, it is something I wanted to bring up in the beginning of the podcast, but now I just remember it, because many people up until the Red Wedding and even beyond always said that episode 4 was the best episode. And I always thought that this was a bit unfair, because the episode had definitely the coolest and most badass ending and a real monumental payoff. With Dany roasting the Astapori slavers and acquiring her Unsullied. It is, of course, a great scene. It is the battle of Minas Tirith of Game of Thrones. But does this actually make the episode good in and of itself? It brings me back to my question about what is a good episode of Game of Thrones. Because people also say all the time, Blackwater is such a great episode. I mean, it was really exciting. It had this explosion. It had stuff in it. But... of course, you can make more compelling TV when you concentrate on one, two, or three storylines, like the episodes do that are mostly considered the best ones of each given season. But you obviously can't do it with every episode, because if you would concentrate on the single storylines, you would end simply not being able to hold up the chronology. So is this holistic approach... that you just said that you have to watch it as a whole season and stuff, it carries even more water if you consider rating the individual episodes like Tower of the Hand does, because this is really difficult. You can't really compare them. Some have these payoffs and are concentrating on stuff and are therefore more satisfying immediately, and others are just the setup, the build-up. And I think it is not really coincidence that Martin always wrote the payoff episodes, the stuff in which you really get the whole emotional punch in it and all that stuff, and not the boring setup episodes.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's coincidence. So I always judged it a bit unfair that people said, oh, he's still the best at the material. He got the juiciest scripts out of it. So what do you think?
I was looking through my reviews, and I remembered that I had called an episode Perfect Game, the name of the review. And it wasn't episode 4, it was episode 5. And I was trying to look over, you know, what happened in episode 5? Was there any big, giant moment? And, like, no. there wasn't. It was just a whole lot of storylines advanced a bit at a time in ways that were very, very effective. You had, I mean, I guess what's the climax of this episode? Is it, or what's the high point of this episode? Is it John having sex with a Greet, which again I think was super duper hot. Was it the whole bathtub scene with Jaime and Brienne, which was unbelievably well acted and revealing in all sorts of ways? Was it Rob executing Rickard Karstark, you know, in this echo of Theon's execution of Roger Castle that showed that Rob had come to something of a sorry pass? You know, you had the whole, all the business on Dragonstone, which was nuts. Loras Tyrell having sex with some dude, the duel between Sandor and Beric. The I Can Be Your Family thing with Arya and Gendry. You know, I mean, it's just a lot of, it's just a lot of emotional moments and little bits of action. And it's, and, you know, and contrary to, trust me, as a TV critic, you really come to sense from your peers, and this is not a swipe at any of them, what the acceptable lines of criticism are for any given show. You know, on Mad Men, it's that Don's not changing. And in Game of Thrones, it's that it's better when it all focuses on one thing than when it does a million things at once. But it can do a million things at once extremely effectively.
Yes.
And, you know, Second Sons, whichever episode that was, 8, was an example of that.
Yeah.
And episode 5 was an example of that. And don't overlook its facility with doing these things. I think it's very, very, very cool that they can keep all those balls moving. And just because we as TV viewers are conditioned to look for something more in the vein of Mad Men season 5, which had this string of like 5 very self-contained, very distinct episodes with the beginning, middle, and end that had their own, each had their own tone, each had their own vibe. And they're incredible. I think it's maybe the single best season of television ever aired, but it doesn't need to be that way. You can do this episode, this heavily, heavily serialized storytelling and come up with a great episode that isn't Blackwater. Although I do think Blackwater is the best episode of the show, so you know, maybe I'm maybe I need to watch my mouth or something. I don't know.
No. I definitely don't think it's the best one. As I said, I don't really judge what's the best one. I have some that are definitely not the best ones in season 2 where Jon's featured, but that's about it. So I guess that's it, more or less. Game of Thrones is fucking fantastic, and I enjoy every single episode of it. Some more, some less, but most more. And I guess most of our readers do too. So, yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun to watch. It was a lot of fun to write about as extensively as I did. It was a lot of fun. The people who on Boiled Leather who do the Ask Me Anythings and talk to me about the show week after week. You know, no offense to my paymasters at Rolling Stone, but it beats the shit out of the comment section on my Rolling Stone reviews. So I really appreciate everyone who's asked questions, you know, both critical and people who are on my wavelength about the show, whether good or bad, and people who, you know, disagree and are having a hard time with different things the show does. I prize the chance to talk to you about that and hash those issues out, because it's really helped me understand what's important to me about this show and what's important to me about television and what's important to me about fiction and art. It's why I like writing and talking about this stuff. And I think my favorite thing about Game of Thrones in general is that it gives you that opportunity. You can talk about the show in a lot of different ways, and that's a big part of what makes it such a rewarding facet of the TV landscape, I think. Whether you are crazy about it, or lukewarm, or you run hot and cold, or whatever the case may be, it's it rewards attention. And it's not like Walking Dead, where it's dumb, and so it gets people talking about how dumb it is.
Oh, yes. Know. Oh, don't get started.
Right. I mean, that's the classic example of, you know, comic book people who work at Marvel or DC, when they put out some terrible comic book and pisses fans off because they treated some character stupidly. It's like, hey, we're, you know, just that we're getting a discussion shows that you're doing something right. No, it doesn't.
No.
But this is the right kind of discussion. So, especially with you, Stefan, my friend.
Oh, thanks. I'm feeling all warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, and that's how every Game of Thrones episode ends, just leaving you feeling warm and fuzzy.
So yeah, exactly.
I guess that's
content.
Exactly. So I guess that's where we'll end this podcast. So thank you, as always, Stefan, for taking the time to speak with me. It's awesome to talk to you. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.